Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Susan Machtinger, a nutritionist. Some of her information is out in front. Some of her food is out in front. This is an unusual topic for Monday Night Philosophy, but as we say, we're going to mind and body connection. Body's obviously extremely useful to us, and food is obviously extremely useful to our bodies. So, Susan.
Thank you. Thank you, George. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club of California and the Monday Night Philosophy Series for inviting me here this evening. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming. It's really a pleasure. I always enjoy speaking to the community, particularly about the subject of food, which I'm extremely passionate about. And so hopefully we'll have a good time tonight. As George said, I'm a nutritionist. I'm based up in Marin County and Sonoma County area. I practice a form of nutrition known as holistic nutrition. And the goal of holistic nutrition is to help people create diets that optimize health using food in its natural state or food in as close to its natural state as possible. So tonight I'm going to talk about the philosophy of food. And I think I'll start by asking, what is the philosophy of food? And I've decided, I probably could have defined this any way I wanted to, but I decided that I would define it as a rational investigation of the truths and principles of our conduct and values toward food and food choices. And in so doing tonight, I want to look at kind of where we are now as a culture with respect to our approach to food and food choice, talk a little bit about how we got here and some of the deeper, more ancient ideas and beliefs that underlie some of our modern approaches toward food. And then finally talk about what we can do as individuals to have better diets and a healthier planet. Because our philosophy of food ultimately is our philosophy of life. And it has to be an accurate reflection of our values and priorities, both as individuals and as a society, in order for us to be in a state of optimal health and for our planet to remain healthy. So let's start out by looking a little bit at where we are now. French epicure and food writer Antelme Brillat-Savarin once said, "Tell me what you eat and I will tell you who you are." And so let's look at a little bit at who we are as a culture right now. The bottom line is we're a bunch of pretty unhealthy people in this culture, and a lot of it has to do with the food that we're eating. Just to give you a few ideas, a few statistics, one of the biggest problems we're facing as a culture right now is we have a situation where we are experiencing both obesity and malnutrition. And you say, well, gee, there's nothing new about that. Probably from the time people began to form cities or come together and live in groups, there would be one group of people that were obese and another group of people that were malnourished. The problem we have right now in our culture is that that phenomenon is occurring where the two conditions are occurring in the same individuals. And that's because what we have is a food supply that has an abundance, an overabundance of empty calories and a deficit of essential nutrients. And that's leading us into some bad places. We are dealing with widespread disease in this culture that's directly attributable to our food choices. And just for an example, diabetes is a disease that has a very large connection to the food that people eat and the food choices that they make. In 2009, according to the Centers for Disease Control, there were about 23 million diabetics in the United States, and about two-thirds of those diabetics suffered from type 2 diabetes, which comes out to about 14 million people. About one out of every 17 to 18 people in the United States right now has type 2 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes is a condition which is directly related to food. It used to be a disease of old age, and now it's being found in children. The Pediatric Obesity Center at UCSF, for example, is now diagnosing type 2 diabetes in preschoolers, which was unheard of even a few years ago. The number of diabetics in the United States is up threefold since 1980, and the CDC estimates that by the year 2050, one in three Americans may suffer from diabetes. This is a life-altering, life-changing, potentially fatal disorder that is directly attributable to the food that people eat. Another diet-related malady that's very common in our culture right now is cardiovascular disease. About 26% of all deaths in the United States are directly attributable to cardiovascular disease. There are six major risk factors that they identify as putting a person at risk for cardiovascular disease, and four of those six are directly attributable to diet. The six factors are inactivity, which is a lifestyle issue, but not related to diet. The second is smoking, which is also not related to diet. But the other four are directly related to diet. And those factors are obesity, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes. I believe there are three main factors that are driving this phenomenon in our culture. One of them is the decline in home food preparation. The second one is the fact that we have a highly adulterated food supply. And the third is widespread food addiction in our culture. Take a look at the first one. We no longer cook at home or cook for ourselves. We have basically, as a culture, abdicated the responsibility for preparing our food to industrial sources. Just for an example, in the year 2008, the USDA did a study where they found that 48.9% of all food dollars were spent on food consumed away from home. Now, that number may have gone down somewhat given what's happened in the economy in the past couple of years, but it's still a very, very large proportion of our food money is actually spent on food that is eaten away from home. When you think of what people are buying to take home, the problem becomes even more obvious, because many people may buy food in a grocery store and bring it home for what's considered home preparation, but it's food that's been prepared in a factory, put into a box, frozen, sent to the grocery store. We buy it in the box, take it home, put it in our microwave oven, heat it up for a few minutes, and eat it. And so many people in our society have simply no longer really have any idea how to cook. And they have no idea how to choose food, and they're very confused about what foods are healthy and what foods are not. So I think the decline in home cooking has caused us, the quality of our food, to suffer. The second factor is that we have a highly adulterated food supply. Just in terms of crops, in the year 2001, which was the last year that the FDA had records on how much pesticide was dumped, 4.9 billion, that's billion with a B, billion pounds of pesticides were used on American food crops. Out of that, about 97% of that ran off of the crops and went into the groundwater or into the soil or into the surface water surrounding those crops. The other 3% went into us. There are no reporting requirements for genetically modified organisms, which are widely used in our food supply now. We are releasing these new forms of life into the biosphere and putting them into our bodies with absolutely no idea what's going on, what the effect is, what the downstream effects will be, or what the immediate effects are. And the third thing are in food animals. Most food animals that are used for general consumption in the United States right now are raised on what they call these CAFE, it's a great little acronym, CAFE feeding operations. CAFE is an acronym that stands for Concentrated Animal Feeding Enterprise. And you will have a situation, for example, like in South Carolina, there's one particular facility, 4 million hogs are confined into an area of less than a square mile with absolutely no provision whatsoever made for sewage disposal of any kind. Now, I come from the country, so I know how big a hog is. And they're about almost as big as we are. I mean, a hog is a big animal. Imagine a city of 4 million people with absolutely no sewage facilities connected to it whatsoever. And imagine if those people were crammed so close together they couldn't even turn around and were given no opportunity to be able to relieve themselves in a civilized way. You start to get the idea what's going on in these places. In order to keep these animals from all dying in mass, what they have to do is inject them with massive amounts of antibiotics. It's estimated that two-thirds of the antibiotics produced in the United States now are being put into food animals prophylactically to keep them from contracting disease. Because when you've got your animals that close together in any kind of a situation, and one animal, all you need is one animal to get sick, you can imagine how quickly disease would spread in an environment like that. So they prophylactically administer massive amounts of antibiotics to these animals. They also administer significant amounts of growth hormone and steroid-type hormones that mimic human reproductive hormones are also widely injected into these animals because it makes them grow faster. Or in the case of dairy cattle, they can extend the period of lactation in the animal between breeding sessions and get more milk from the animal by doing that. So these things, every single thing that goes into that food animal, you eat that food, it goes right into you, and it's not doing well for our bodies. These animals probably would die of the effects of being fed and housed and cared for the way that they are if we didn't kill them. It's a race to see if we can get them into the slaughterhouse and kill them in time. But we see the long-term effects of these sorts of products and chemicals in the bodies of other animals, namely ourselves, over time, and we're seeing it in the form of widespread disease. The other thing that is driving a lot of this problem is widespread food addiction in this country, and it's tied into the fact that it's the other side of the coin, really, of our abdication of the responsibility for preparing our own food. Much of the time, we've turned our preparation over to industrial interests who cannot remain in business unless they make money, and the quickest way to make money is to cut your expenses and raise your profits. And so what we have are foods that have been deliberately created to change our brain chemistry to drive us into a state of hyperactive overeating. They create a mixture. They basically have figured out the science of craveability. And there's a very interesting book on this by a man named David Kessler called The End of Overeating. And he very carefully documents exactly how these scientists of they're actually a recognized specialty in food science of craveability, and they have figured out how to manipulate fat, salt, and sugar in such a way that the food is not satisfying. The food doesn't satiate people. It stimulates them into an addictive, sort of almost like a drug. It goes into the brain and attaches to the same pathways in the brain that a drug would attach to and drives the person into a state of overeating. So people will taste this food and they will eat and they will eat and they will eat and they will eat. And it's a game you can't win because you can't get full. They've fixed it so you can't get full. And that's leading to obesity. And the people who are really being targeted by this industry, and this is the thing that gets under my skin more than anything else, is the people who are really being targeted by the food industries are our children and our grandchildren. All you have to do is watch TV for 15 minutes on a Saturday morning and you know exactly who these people's target audience is. And so we have preschoolers being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So how did we get here? How did we get into this situation? I think we have some deeply held cultural presumptions that have led to this, and I think some of them have roots in some of our oldest cultural ancestors. And I want to look at a couple of them. I thought it would be sort of interesting to look at, like, deeply held concepts. And so I want to talk a little bit about the Greeks, and I want to talk a little bit about the Bible, and then I'm going to talk about the Industrial Revolution, which is what really drove this thing. But the Greeks gave us some interesting ideas, and since I had a chance to do a philosophy lecture, I just couldn't resist talking about the Greeks. When am I going to get another chance as a nutritionist to talk about the Greeks? So there's two things I want to talk about with the Greeks. One of them is the idealization of meat, and the second one is the memory and the echo of Epicurus. So The ancient Greeks idealized the consumption of meat, and they tied it into ideas of masculinity and male prowess. And they probably got this, historians think they probably got this as an echo from their early ancestors who were nomads from Central Asia, who no doubt lived through hunting, and it probably really was true that, you know, the guy who got the most, who could, like, kill the most animals and bring home the most things at the end of a pointy stick, you know, probably got all the ladies, and, you know, the culture went on that way. By the time we got to the Greeks, it was more of an idea than a practice. There's a couple of interesting places in Greek literature, I think, where this becomes apparent. One of them is in the Iliad, and it has to do with a feast. Achilles invites Odysseus for a feast at on the beach outside the walls of Troy. And it's kind of funny when you think about it, because what had been going on, I'm certainly not going to go through the whole Iliad here, but during this period of time, like right up leading to this feast, what has happened is that Odysseus and Achilles have always been rivals, and all through the story they're rivals. But they've both basically are a couple of Bronze Age draft dodgers who've sort of been busted. You know, Odysseus goes through this whole thing where he tries to convince everyone that he's become insane, and he begins acting like a maniac. He sows his fields with salt, all this kind of stuff. He ultimately, it doesn't work. And Achilles, what is Achilles? Achilles, the great warrior, he's running around in a dress. Okay, he's hanging out. He's trying to pretend that he's part of his friend's daughter's entourage. Well, this is Greek literature, and Greek literature being what it is, the gods are not going to stand for this. There has to be a battle, and these guys are heroes, and they got to get their hero mojo back, right? So they both get busted. They're both going to have to go fight the Trojan War, and so they sort of, you know, they slink their way over to Troy, and they have to work out their differences if they're going to work this out. And so what does Achilles do? He invites Odysseus to a barbecue, and Homer goes into a lot of detail about it. They dig a big pit, and this is not just the two men. This is the camps of the two men, the followers, and so it's quite a large group of people, and they dig a great big pit, and they put a big grate on top of it, and they build a big fire, and they go out, and they kill all kinds of animals, and they whack them up, and they hack them up, and they throw them on the grill, and they sit there, and they eat meat, and they work it out, and they figure out how they're going to, what they think at the time is how they're going to get through this. Now, the Iliad goes on for a really long time, and they don't really work it out, but that's beside the point. But the fact is how do these two guys, who have essentially surrendered something of their masculinity in the interest of maybe staying alive and not having to go to war, get it back? How do they more or less man up in a way that's going to allow them to continue to go on? Because the gods are not going to tolerate this draft dodger stuff anymore. What do? They sit down and they eat copious amounts of meat. And in the process of doing that, they regain their masculinity and their prowess as heroes, actually, through this consumption of meat. And this has echoed down through history, that men, masculinity and meat consumption and the idealization of meat go together. I grew up in an Irish-American family, and there was a saying, my grandmother used to have a saying during hard times, that when there was meat on the table, the men ate it and the women looked at it. And, you know, you look out, every suburban house in this country's got a Weber kettle in the backyard, and who's out there in his apron, right? Who's out there? It's Dad. So this idealization of meat was very popular with the Greeks, and it's come down to us. There were also any number of things written that would cult almost the cults around many of these Olympic champions. There was a guy named Milon of Croton who was rumored, he was a famous wrestler, he was rumored to have maintained his strength by consuming 20 pounds of meat a day. Again, that made him, and they go on and on about how strong he is and how masculine he is and how, you know, because he eats lots of meat, you know. The reality in ancient Greece was that the Greeks didn't eat much meat at all. They didn't believe that they could kill their domestic animals for food without making a sacrifice to the gods. To kill a domestic animal and eat it just because you were hungry or because you felt like it was considered an act almost beneath contempt. It was a totally cowardly act. About the only time these people got meat was when they could find wild game, which was relatively abundant, and they probably did eat a fair amount of wild game. Otherwise, they ate barley, onions, fruit, olives, diluted wine, and usually greens that they could gather. They gathered a lot of their own food. They had a lot of stuff along the ground that they could pick up, and they would eat that. So I get this image of, you know, these men in ancient Greece, that meat was really a lot like sex for these guys. They probably spent a lot more time thinking about it and talking about it than they did actually having it, you know. I think we retain that idealization of meat and this tie to the masculine ideal in our culture to some extent. The other guy I couldn't resist talking about was Epicurus. And I just had to, because every time I told anyone I was doing this talk, they would go, oh, philosophy and food, you're going to talk about Epicurus, right? I said, okay, sure. Epicurus didn't talk very much about food, but he did give us some information that's useful. Who was Epicurus? He was a philosopher and teacher. He lived toward the golden age of Greece. He was born in 341 BCE. He died in 270 BCE. He ran a school called the Garden, which was just that. It was a big, open, kind of outdoor space that was pleasant and lovely to be at, and people came, and just the kind of the way you might imagine a Greek philosopher's garden school might be, at least as far as I can tell. I didn't see it, but this is what people wrote about. he was a cool guy. Epicurus was a really cool guy. He was an empiricist. He, in a time when people believed that that wisdom came from the gods and from fate and from oracles, Epicurus said, "Nah, wisdom comes from experience, and you can become wise simply by making choices, reflecting on those choices, and living your life. And if you've lived a life well lived, at the end, will result in a wise person, essentially." He was also an egalitarian in a culture that was not egalitarian at all. He welcomed women to the garden. He welcomed slaves to the garden, former slaves, lower class Athenians, upper class Athenians. If you could figure out how to work out the time and how to work out hanging out with Epicurus, you were welcome, which was very, very different from the highly stratified society that characterized most of the Golden Age of Athens. He believed that pleasure was the highest good, that pain is evil and to be avoided, and he believed that this was true of food as well as other aspects in life. And so part of living a good life, part of seeking the good in life, was the consumption and enjoyment of good food, and hence our modern term Epicurean ideas. He's often associated with hedonism in the West, and that's probably because he was an atheist. So he couldn't get elected. He probably couldn't get himself elected president of the United States right now. And he wasn't the most popular guy in Athens because of this. But he really wasn't. One of the main things that he told his disciples was that to find true wisdom and to find true happiness, you had to forego short-term pleasure if the cost for that short-term pleasure was long-term pain. And so he really wasn't a hedonist. I mean, in the sense that a hedonist would just say, let's do it now, you know, kind of thing. He really did take the long view in life, and he believed that caring for one's health and making choices that led to a healthy life and a long life was part of doing good. And so I'm going to come back to Epicurus later. The Bible is also at the heart of many aspects of Western culture, obviously, including a few of the ideas we have about food. And I thought there were a couple in there in particular that were kind of interesting. Of course, we start with the Hebrew Bible, or what Jews call the Torah. And in the beginning, we know a couple of things. We know that, according to the Bible, we started out in a garden. We also had a garden in our ideas. And that we were made in God's image. And that man had dominion over the animals. But when you're in the Garden of Eden, dominion doesn't mean much. You know, like, you don't really need dominion when all your needs are met. Dominion kind of comes up in an economy of scarcity. And so, but everybody was happy, and we had the peaceful kingdom. Then, of course, everything fell apart, and there was this cataclysmic reordering of the world. And when the dust settled, we found ourselves with a rather troubling duality, because when everything was said and done, and man looked at himself, on the one hand, here he was made in the image of God, but on the other hand, he was kind of an opportunistic, relatively aggressive, omnivorous animal that pretty much had to eat other living things in order to stay alive. And this idea of, like, being created in the image of God and being given life by God and having this echo of the creative force of God within you, and having to go out and, like, eat something that's alive in order to survive was a real problem for these people. Modern people don't have as much problem, I think, with the idea that we're animals. You know, we can kind of get downwards, tangled and dark. You know, we kind of like that Discovery Channel stuff. You know, we don't mind that, you know. The ancients struggled with this. They didn't like this at all. So we find in the Bible there is this thread that sort of roams through the Bible where they sort of keep coming back to this issue and then going on to other things, and then they come back to this issue. And animal, you know, God's creation, given life, taking life, and all this sort of stuff. Very, very difficult. So, for example, in Genesis 7 is the first place we get any sort of real instruction about how to eat. And Genesis 7 is in the story of Noah, and it's where it's in the place in the story where the rain has stopped, the flood is receding. You know, the animals are kind of, I picture the animals are going back down the ramp, you know, and everything. And God is kind of debriefing Noah at this point. He says, all right, you know, here's the deal, all right? Here's what you can eat. I give you the green plant, he says at this point. And then he goes on for a while, and they talk about lineage, and they do some other things. And then he says, almost in passing at the end of the passage, and then God sort of says, oh, yeah, and by the way, you can eat anything that moves pretty much, except you can't eat its blood. He doesn't say why. Now, Noah's been through something of an ordeal here. You know, he doesn't really ask why. He just goes like, okay, and we'll do this. And we don't find out why until all the way over to the other side of the Exodus in Leviticus 7, when we find out that the reason you're not supposed to eat the blood of an animal is because its soul is contained in its blood. In Deuteronomy 12, we get what are called the rules of Sheketah, which is the rule of humane slaughter, which is followed to this day by observant Jews. And it has to do with an animal. The animal must be perfect. The animal must be killed by one blow of a very sharp knife through the neck that severs the jugular vein, and the animal exsanguinates very quickly because you have this exsanguination requirement. And then later in Deuteronomy 14 is where most of the Jewish so-called Jewish dietary laws are revealed during the Exodus. When we get into Christianity, looking to the Christian Bible, Jesus didn't talk about food very much, probably because he was an observant Jew. He probably figured it was settled. He didn't really need to deal with it very much. So the guy who the job of figuring out Christianity and food fell to the Apostle Paul for the most part. He had a really tough job on his hands because he had to try to create a community out of a huge multicultural empire that was strung over an enormous amount of space. And he was trying to hold together these disparate congregations and communities in an era where communication on a good day went at the speed of a horse's hooves. And so he had bigger fish to fry, but they kept asking him about it. You know, and we know some of the details of Paul's ministry, obviously, through his letters, through the epistles. And so in fourth book of Timothy, he can almost hear his frustration. He says, look, all right, you know, nothing created by God should be rejected. You know, can you guys just get along, you know, kind of thing. But he retains the requirement of exsanguination. He says, yeah, you can eat anything you want, but you must adhere to this old requirement of exsanguination. And this goes on for a while, and then finally, he in Colossians 7, he sort of sums it up, and he tells people, he says, look, it's what you believe. You know, this is a community that's going to be based on belief, not on food behavior. The substance belongs to Christ, he says. And don't judge others with regard to their food and their drink. And you guys can basically go out. You can eat whatever you want as long as you exsanguinate the animal first. So what has that got to do with today? The rejection of the humane slaughter rules by the early Christian community allowed people in Europe, which is where most of our sort of cultural backgrounds come from in the United States, allowed them to basically get this animal dead and bled the quickest way possible or whatever way worked for them. And so what we ended up with to a large extent in European culture was a so-called stun and stick means of slaughtering animals, which is used in slaughterhouses today. And it basically what they do is rather than kill the animal quickly like they would under Sheketah, they hit it in the head so that it's supposedly rendered unconscious, and then they stick it where they basically just gash open some part of the animal where it will bleed a lot, either near the groin or up in the chest cavity, bleed it out, and then they go through the process of, you know, skinning it and dismembering it. When you're doing that in a barnyard in Nebraska in the 19th century or something, it's probably not such a bad way to kill. I mean, if you know what you're doing, it can be a pretty humane way to kill an animal. If you're working in a slaughterhouse where you are expected to stun an animal every 10 seconds, you can have some real slip-ups that result in some horrendous cruelty and really, really ugly situations. And that's what's going on in slaughterhouses in the United States now. So they have these big guns where they stun the – it looks like a jackhammer. It's got this huge thing that comes out, hits, for example, the cow in the head. And then the animal's strung up by its leg, and it's stuck, and it's bled, and then it's skinned. The problem is they – are forced to work so quickly in these slaughterhouses that the animals come to on the line and they're slaughtered. They're literally dismembered while they're alive, which from a moral perspective is something we need to take into consideration when we think about where we're buying our meat. But the thing that, you know, what really changed everything for us in terms of food in the Western world was the Industrial Revolution. You can't understate it. It was the primary driving factor in the development of the modern food culture. We have a guy named Frederick Winslow Taylor to thank for this, good or bad. He wrote a book in 1911 called The Principles of Scientific Management that basically created the modern assembly line. Henry Ford began working with Taylor, sometimes Taylorism and Fordism. They even refer to it as Fordism. And it was basically, you know, all the tasks accomplished in one big area where you could keep an eye on people. Interchangeable parts and interchangeable workers, tasks broken down in such a way that you didn't need people that had much skill so that people could kind of be switched in and out on the line, and you know, this, you could just accomplish what you needed to do. Taylorism began to be applied to farming in the United States in the 1920s, and the result of that was that basically food production became just another industry. The connection to the ground, the connection to, you know, the old ideas of animal husbandry or self-sufficiency or whatever, kind of were lost in the Industrial Revolution. So what we had was massive urbanization and a drastic reduction in household size, and also a drastic reduction in the amount of time people spend at home. And the rise of the restaurant industry, obviously, which is a good and a bad thing. I mean, I love eating out. I'm going to eat out when I leave here today. But what really resulted from all of this was, as time moved on, if we go forward a few decades and we start looking at the post-World War II era, the 1950s and forward, was the rise of the so-called convenience food. And this became basically an industrially produced product that was subject to Taylorism sort of ideas of, you know, precise measurements of exactly the cost of every single thing going in and shaving off cost anywhere you could, all the way down the line, until what you ended up with was absolutely the cheapest, lowest quality products you could lay your hands on that you could cobble together and put into a box and get people to buy. The absolute bottom of this, as far as I was concerned, happened in 1963 when this woman wrote a book called The I Hate to Cook Book, which is absolutely the most horrendous piece of food writing I've ever seen in my entire life. It was the original chicken and Campbell's soup, you know, kind of thing in the container. It represented the bottoming out, I think, when we got there. And then, of course, they invented the science of craveability. So maybe she's beginning to look like an absolute Epicurean at this point. So we basically have a situation now where market forces and profit motive drive industrial food preparation, and our nutritional needs and those of our children are of no importance to the people producing our food a great deal of the time. We've pretty much lost track of the real reason to eat, which is to nourish ourselves, and we've lost track of our natural place, our place in the natural world, because our food choice is the single greatest interaction we have with the natural world. Three times a day, we make a decision about something that's going on in the natural world, because the only place we can get our food is from the natural world. So how do we reconcile modern life and nourishing ourselves? Well, I'd like to talk about three people who I think can provide a little bit of guidance for us. Peter Singer, who is a modern philosopher who talks some about moral considerations in food choice. Brian Swim, who is a cosmologist and talks a lot about the interconnectedness of human activity and the planet and the cosmos. And Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Buddhist philosopher and teacher who talks about consciousness and eating. So what can Peter Singer offer us? First of all, Peter Singer, just as by brief means of introduction, is an Australian philosopher who teaches at Princeton and at the Applied Center for Philosophy at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He specializes in approaching ethical issues from secular and utilitarian perspectives. He proposes a modern morality of eating that takes modern knowledge about science into consideration. And he says that our food choices are never amoral, which I thought was very interesting. It brings to mind a quote by Oscar Wilde where he said, "Morality, like art, means drawing a line somewhere." He stresses that choosing food has to take, you know, several things into consideration. He put out a book in 2006 about food and about food choice where he went into quite a bit of detail. But the takeaway from the book that I felt after reading it was that food pricing should reflect the entire cost of production, that producing food shouldn't expose a lot of the costs of these really negative downstream externalities that are going on with these cafe feeding operations and pesticide overruns and these types of things. They're being passed on to society and we are paying for them, but it's falling disproportionately on some groups of people in society, and it's also, we're missing how expensive this really is by having this artificially lowly priced food that's priced very low. Humanity is another consideration, that inflicting significant suffering on animals for minor gratification is morally wrong, and that we need to, you know, we do need to eat animals. Technically, we need to eat animal products to survive. We can't live without some animal products or some supplementation that mimics those animal products in our bodies. But we need to think about how we're going to do that. And finally, that preserving life and health justifies more than other desires, and that to be choosing food out of habit or just because of the taste when we could nourish ourselves equally well with a different choice, we probably should be making that different choice, that we don't need to go hand to mouth or be completely impulsive about our food choices. The next modern thinker might be described as the ultimate big picture guy, and that's Brian Swim. And he is a mathematical cosmologist who views humanity as an integral part of the universe as a whole. And he writes extensively on the interconnectedness of people and the natural world. And he has he wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Universe Story. And I'm going to quote, I'm going to read just a very, very brief quote from it because I thought it sort of summed up his ideas and gives us some guidance. He says, if the dominant political issue of the 20th century has been between the capitalist and communist worlds, between democratic freedoms and socialist responsibility, the dominant issue of the immediate future will be the tension between those who will continue their plundering and those who will truly preserve the natural world. Between the mechanistic and organic, between the world as a collection of objects and the world as a communion of subjects, between the anthropocentric and the biocentric norms of reality and value. And I think that gives us some guidance in thinking about where our food choices, what our food choices should reflect other than just the immediate impulsive desire to taste something. If you think about, I think his comments are most relevant really to food when we consider how our choices affect, how food choices affect food production. And if you consider how much of the planet's surface is used for food production, it's pretty astounding. I mean, with billions of people and all, if you think of all the farms and all the animal raising operations and the way the rainforests have been cut down to allow cattle to graze, and feeding humans is having an enormous impact on the planet. And it has for a long time, but it's really having a big impact these days. And you think, it brings up the importance of topsoil. And I think it's kind of interesting because Brian Swim likes to say that, you know, we all come from the same things that made up the universe. He's fond of saying we're all stardust. And we kind of live on this stardust in a way, which is our topsoil. And if you think of the Earth, and if you imagine it in your mind, and you cut it in half on cross-section, and then look at that cross-section, you would have, you know, the molten core, and then a big thick stone or rock mantle, and then a relatively narrow crust, and then around the very, very, very edge of this thing, this tiny, tiny, infinitesimal little line of dust, basically, little more than dust, is the topsoil. And without that topsoil, we don't survive. We are absolutely dependent for our very lives on the health of that little layer of stardust, essentially, that is on the surface of the earth. By using organic foods, by supporting the people who do organic farming, you are supporting the augmentation and the replacement and the health of that topsoil. And by buying commercial foods where the topsoil is basically being completely depleted, modern monocrop farming that makes heavy use of chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides is essentially taking a whip to this to the topsoil and beating it to death. And when it's gone, we've got big problems. We really have big problems because we are dependent upon the plants that grow in that topsoil for the nutrients that are in the food. If the basic minerals and building blocks of the nutrients that we need to get from those plants are not present in the soil, those things will not manifest in the tissues of the plant. And that's why organic foods are so much more nutritious than commercial foods are. The other thing is the plants, even if we eat animals, the animals eat the plants that grow in the soil, and they need that in order to survive, so the animals need it as well. And finally, the plants are what are taking in the carbon dioxide and putting out the oxygen that we breathe and are helping to, they provide an atmosphere that we can breathe in, but they also are helping to keep the earth from getting too terribly overheated. So I think Brian Swim gives us some very interesting things to contemplate in terms of food choice. The final person I'd like to talk about is Thich Nhat Hanh, who is a Buddhist monk, teacher, author, poet, and peace activist. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago with a nutritionist from Harvard named Lillian Chung. The book is called Savor. I thought it was fascinating at some level that probably one of the greatest living modern philosophers in the world right now saw fit about 2 years ago to write a book for general public consumption about the importance of consciousness and food choice, And I was really moved by the fact that he wrote the book at all. And then when I read the book, I also was very moved by what he said. He suggests basically that eating with awareness requires that we take the following things into consideration: that obesity leads to disease, and that overeating leads to obesity, that everything we consume, not just our food, but everything we consume defines who we are. So Brillat Savarin said, "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are." Thich Nhat Hanh says, "Tell me what you consume. Tell me everything you consume, and I will tell you who you are." And that was I thought that was rather profound. He teaches that we must develop mindfulness on how our emotions affect our eating, which has a lot to do with food addiction, how our emotions, and also consciousness and awareness of how our emotions are being manipulated through the chemical manipulations of our food. And finally, he says that we must be aware of the interconnectedness of our food choices to the physical world and to society as a whole. In light of all this, it seems apparent to me that our philosophy of food is our philosophy of life, that food is, in essence, kind of a metaphor for life, that we have to consider everything we're feeding in the process of feeding ourselves. So in light of all this, I'd like to leave you with four ideas for creating a system of principles consistent with the truths that we're facing about our modern food system. The first one is that if we're going to eat meat, we must choose sustainably raised and humanely slaughtered animals. The second is that we should choose organically produced food for our own health, for the health of our children, for the preservation of the topsoil, and for the overall health of the planet. The third is that we must prepare and eat food for ourselves, which satisfies and nourishes us, and avoid addiction-engineered foods that stimulate us into a state of hyper-overeating. And the fourth is that we must learn to consume food in a state of awareness about our own emotions and about the effect that our food choices are having on the world around us. So perhaps old Epicurus was right all along, and what we really need to do is to return to the garden. That after all, the sum of all of our choices really do determine the quality of our lives, that we cannot abuse and contradict nature or our own bodies and expect to be truly happy. And in Epicurus's time, as in our own, the choices which sustain us and our earthly home in a state of health are the first good and ultimately will lead to happiness. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Susan. That was extremely interesting, and you certainly lived up to the title. I don't know how many ideas could be gotten into in 40 minutes, but that was just...
Maybe some sort of a land distance record.
One of the things that, by the way, I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that you're listening to Susan Mockinger's talk at the Commonwealth Club of California. We're going to start our question and answer period. One of the things that a lot of people will say in response to a set of ideas about eating or anything like that is, well, you know, Epicurus, maybe he had it right thousands of years ago, and there's always been some people who agree with this approach, but clearly it's not a majority opinion. And it's not likely from any realistic point of view that for the next 100 years it will be a majority point of view, I would think, simply because of the drive of all the motives and everything that are involved. But what is the extreme value of the 5% that go along with the idea? What's the value? What's the value, even if you're only part of the 5% that do this? Do you think that still has the effect that you're looking for?
Yes. In a word, I think that it would be nice if the other 95 would come along, but it's going to be that 5% who are going to lead the way and through their actions are going to illustrate and show the rest of society that it is indeed possible to eat in a consciousness and sustainable way. And the more that people support these types of food choices and the purveyors of foods that produce food in a way that is consistent with a high consciousness moral way of eating, the more of it is going to be available. And the more that people do it, it will grow. The more it will grow, the more these, you know, it is, it's business. I mean, if you patronize a business and you give support to a business, that business will thrive and become larger and more people will buy into it. And we can, yes, if it's 5% right now, that's fine. We can change the world with 5%.
Yeah, that's one of the ones despite the fact that you are not going to convert the population because of all the other motives that are involved, you can say, what's the usefulness of this? Because I worked in energy, for example, and there are a lot of ideas that are already out there that can be used, but they haven't reached the price point yet that make them effective for taking over. Whereas here, like you said, you know, if there's only 0.5% of the people eating organic food, and there's only 2 organic farms, even then the knowledge of how to do it was there, and it has grown a lot in the last 50 years.
Absolutely.
And with it being extremely available, if there's a crisis, then it will spread. But when it spreads, it will have to shift because people will have to go back. People are proud that we spend a smaller and smaller percentage of our income on food, right? And people are going to have to be proud that we're consuming something different and we're spending more money on food again rather than before. So it's a big shift in the way that we look at what we're doing as consumers.
Absolutely.
Economic voting, you talked about that. Economic voting is another way of looking at it. You say everything that you do says this is what I want more of.
Yes, there's also, you know, there's a huge policy piece to this as well. We could be doing this very differently if we had a different policy. If you look at where agricultural subsidies go, for example, it's kind of crazy to think that what we're spending to subsidize corn, for example, which is going into high fructose corn syrup, which is then making us ill, which we're then we're taking care of people with conditions like diabetes, heart disease, obesity. We could change that if we decided to as a culture. And the more people who are aware of that and who are thinking that way and who will make that need and that idea apparent to their elected representatives, the better off we're going to be. I have few illusions about what an uphill battle that is, but I think that the more they hear it, eventually they're going to start to believe it.
You no longer need to prove that you're wealthy enough to have enough food because there's enough food for everybody. But like you said, the quality of it is going on. But on the other hand, that has fed lots and lots of people, increased the population. So that there's, I look at it more as a transition period, and that there's a lot of hope to go back. And it seems like the transition would be a long question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the wonderful talk. I have two questions. First thing is, in this culture, especially in the United States, there's a preoccupation with buying cheap food. Everything has to be cheap. And if you can reflect a little bit on that. And then as a nutritionist, how do you perceive or how do you actually evaluate traditional foods? So I'm from India, and the food choices in India pretty much throughout history. Look at my grandparents, my parents, and even myself. Is we determine what is available in season. We're strict vegetarians, so you know these vegetables, these fruits are available in this season, and that's how our diet. So even if there are festivals, the festival foods are determined by the season. So thank you so much.
Let's see if I can remember what your first question was now. Cheap food, yes. Well, I think Peter Singer's idea about, you know, the total cost of food is really, really instructive here. People are, yeah, there is an attitude in our culture that food is supposed to be cheap. I think people need to understand that food really isn't cheap at all when you look at what the total cost of it is, and that we could affect policy that would that could be done in a way that the total cost of a food would be reflected in the cost of that food. That having been said, I think it's a very real issue in our culture that many people simply can't afford to buy fruits and vegetables because we have a subsidy structure that makes unhealthy foods cheap and makes healthy food expensive. And there are things being done, you know, there are small steps being taken in that direction. The ultimate answer to that, I believe, is going to happen on a policy level. And, you know, Congress created one set of policies. Congress can create another set of policies. In the meantime, there are things like community-supported agriculture where people can order foods less expensive, high-quality foods less expensively directly from local producers, which that's a good option in this area because we have so many farms around us and so much we are in a major food-producing area. There are farmers' markets. And where farmers come directly, again, you cut out the middleman. There are garden projects and community gardens, school gardens. We're starting to make inroads into that area. Even food banks. I work, I teach at a nutrition college in Sonoma County, and one of the things we have our students do is our students go into the food banks where the farmers bring in their excess, like extra crops or gleaned produce from their fields, and we do classes showing people actually how to use these foods and trying to bring people and food together. That's one very small example, but we're not alone. And so the cheap food is a problem. I mean, we need to break through the idea that, I mean, people need to understand what's really expensive about this and what isn't. And part of that is education. In terms of choosing food as a nutritionist, I'm definitely in favor of doing local food, seasonal food. When I teach my students to look for soul food, S-O-U-L, which is seasonal, organic, unadulterated, and local foods, as much as they possibly can. And so, yes, I think the idea, people need to get used to the idea, again, of eating seasonally, and they need to get used to the idea, again, of eating locally. The average food item in the United States in a supermarket has probably traveled at least 2,000 miles before it got to you. That's crazy. You know, that's a very crazy thing to do. And people can, you know, make inroads to that, at least individuals in the individual level, by buying locally from local producers and seeking out local producers. And again, economic voting, rewarding vendors which bring in high quality products that are made locally and are in season.
One comment to avoid, I think one issue that comes up a lot with eating is that you get too much fear about trying to do it all perfectly.
Well, that's true. Yeah, people can get really obsessed and really crazy, and it's pretty basic, really. You know, you want to eat vegetables. You want to eat a plant-based diet. You want to eat your vegetables. If you're going to eat grains, eat whole grains. Protein sources. You don't need a 14-ounce T-bone every night for dinner. You know, if you're going to eat animal products, a few ounces of meat a day will sustain you. You know, an egg once in a while. My daughter is a vegan most of the time, and I always say, look, you know, just one egg a week. Just to get the B12 in there, you know, kind of thing. But yeah, it's different.
And the one thing that your body, of course, gets rid of the poisons. It's just that if you overwhelm it with poisons. So if you cut back to a minor amount of it, your body can take care of the minimal amount.
You mentioned foods that were engineered to be craveable or.
Yes. One good example is Chili's restaurant. If you have the chicken at Chili's restaurant, it has been injected in the factory before it gets to the restaurant with a scientifically engineered juice or potion that's actually injected in, like, it's literally like a machine with these big hypodermic needles in it that like go down into the meat and inject this broth that is this engineered proportion of sugar, fat, and salt that will make the meat, that will make people crave the meat and eat more of it. Then they put a sugar sauce on top of that, and that's just one example. Most of the big fast food companies engage in a certain amount of craveability studies. The Big Mac, for example, has been engineered and re-engineered and re-engineered. McDonald's spent $500 million I think it was in either 2007 or 2008, just engineering the mouthfeel on a Big Mac so that it would have exactly the right texture. And they put people through functional MRI machines and feed them parts of this food, and they watch where the brain lights up. It's the honest truth. It's crazy. It's amazing. Pardon me? Yeah, it's a combination of sugar, fat, and salt. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's not unusual. That's not unusual. I think it's our children. And this stuff is definitely being marketed to our kids. They give you a toy with it. If you buy, they do. Maybe not in San Francisco for long, but most places you can get a toy with this stuff on top of everything else.
Thank you.
I think it's hard to say. It's hard to say if I don't know if the way that farming is structured right now, if we tried to change it all tomorrow, if we would be able to put it all into place. I think there's certain things that could be done that would make it much more likely that organic farming would sustain most of the population. One would be to eat fewer animal foods. There would still be some animal foods around, but we are putting so much of our acreage into fodder for cheap food animals. And so if people could still continue to eat animal products, but they could eat far less than they do now and remain healthy. They probably, in fact, considering how much meat some people eat, many people eat, they'd probably be better off cutting back a little bit. So that would free up some space for human food. The other thing is to control some of the waste. Like in the United States right now, half of all the food produced in the United States is thrown away. And so if we had less waste, we could probably reuse or reposition some of our resources into creating more organically produced foods. And it's, they're getting better at large-scale organic agriculture, which some people, it's just, when they talk about, like, organic from Walmart, people kind of go, oh, man, that's like fingernails down the chalkboard, kind of thing. But they kind of, some of that might have to happen in order for everything to go organic. But even if we were doing organic on a large scale, because of the topsoil preservation, it would probably be worth it. I don't know off the top of my head if right now with the way things are structured and everything, we could make a one-for-one change immediately. But I absolutely believe down to the last fiber of my being that it's possible to do it. Right. If we're eating fewer of them, then we won't need to raise as many of them.
Exactly.
And I think education is a big part of it, and I think there are more entities in the society other than just it's not just nutritionists who are leading the who are leading the charge. I think if you look at, for example, Alice Waters and the School Gardens Project, that was that started out very small but has actually gotten big. There's a lot of that going on now. That's a good example, I think, of sort of a grassroots idea that has really taken off. People really like that idea, and I think if it's one example of a good way to start, because if we teach the kids to value these things and to understand these things, that's the next generation, and those people may very well go on to incorporate those ideas into their living as they go on. Clergy, the only area I'm really familiar with the food bank system in is Sonoma County, because that's where I teach. And we have a number of clergy who participate in our food groups that do. We have a women's canning program, for example. I don't teach in that program, but my assistant does. And they do gleaning, and then these are low-income people who don't have kitchens large enough to do canning. If your mother grew her own food, you know about canning. My grandmother did, too. You need a big space. So they use the church kitchens. They open them up a couple days a month, and they bring in the produce, and then it's usually women who are there. They're instructed on how to can the stuff they spend an afternoon canning, and then they take home the food in a form that doesn't have to be refrigerated. So there's some of that going on, not a lot, but I know of two or three places where that's happening in Sonoma. So there's little, pinpoints here and there where it's kind of moving. But I think part of it is, just living your life. When you walk into a restaurant, say, is this sustainable? Is this local? or patron, again, you know, if a restaurant does use sustainable local stuff, go there and tell your friends about it. And, you know, I think it's more than just the hippies, you know. I think it's more than just, you know, I think I sort of, you know, I don't know. I hung up my Birkenstocks a number of years ago, and I'm still doing this,
you know. Well, thanks, Susan. That's a great line to end on.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. And also, I want to thank the online and radio audiences. And if anyone would like to stay and ask questions of Susan, we didn't have time for all the questions, I know, so you can stay afterwards and ask. And this brings to an end another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 107th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.